The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
From St. Louis Public Radio, this is Politically Speaking.
In just a few months, Missouri Republicans will go to the polls to choose their nominee for the U.S. Senate. And there's a host of factors that could determine the outcome of a wide-open primary. To break things down, we talk with former State Senator John Lamping about the GOP primary's dynamics and a host of other issues that are gripping Missouri politics at the moment. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
We have to talk about things that matter to people.
I've tried to bring that same aggressive, iconoclast style with me to the United States Senate.
I think my district is a model for the state.
We put Missourians first.
You just kind of have to find the common ground with people.
I believe that this district deserves someone who represents their values.
After I came back to St. Louis, I started thinking that I could have a bigger role on the change that I wanted to make.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. We have a very special guest today in the studio. The last time he was on the show, he was the state senator for Missouri's 24th district, and it was in 2014.
Amazing.
And our guest today is?
John Lamping.
And I'm really appreciative of him coming back because he's not in office anymore. Some of our best guests that we've had on this show have been former office holders that still pay attention to Missouri politics. I think about a year after you were on, we had Jason Kroll on the show.
Oh,
and
yeah,
it was
Jason's
like
great.
one of the best shows we've ever had, yeah. Because at that point, with the exception of him coming back in 2017 to shake up the low-income housing tax credit program, he's pretty much out of politics and doesn't
really... but Jason's watching.
He's
yeah,
watching.
He pays attention. I talk to Jason
yeah,
often enough.
But he has good perceptions.
And yes, he does.
I think that the reason I wanted to bring you back is, you know, we have this crazy U.S. Senate race going on right now. You definitely have been paying attention to it. You have either peripheral or personal relationships with a lot of the candidates. But just to make sure, you haven't endorsed anybody yet.
No, and nor will I in this race.
Yeah. So which I think that makes you a good person to talk about the dynamics of this. At least that's my thought now. Ask me again at the end of the show and
right.
Maybe I'll have a different opinion. So I'm going to ask you, before we get into the individual candidates, what is kind of your sense of where this GOP Senate primary is right now?
Well, I think the race is really a race between Schmidt and Hartzler. I think Greitens represents kind of the populist nationalist message in this race, and that's a message that is sweeping the country in Republican Party circles. But the rest of the candidates here in Missouri are not interested in taking up those issues. That's actually given room for Greitens to fill that ideological space. And if you listen to him, that's what he's all about. Again, that's a very popular message. And in a lot of places around the country, that message itself is getting Trump's endorsement. But Eric has got a ceiling of maybe 25 or 30, and he's a floor. We're going to find out what his floor is after the last few weeks. And what's happened is that Schmidt and Hartzler have both organized pretty effective-looking campaigns, and we're 4 months out, and I think we're just going to see a traditional political campaign between the two of them. And unless something crazy happens, I think the winner will be up amongst those two.
So we're going to go backwards. We're going to get to Schmidt, Hartzler, and Greitens at the end of this line of questioning. But I want to go backwards about this field, which, by the way, I think has 20 or 21 candidates.
Right.
And I want to actually talk about the non-major candidates first, which may seem counterintuitive. But, you know, in a crowded primary where there are multiple legitimate candidates and in a possibility that the race could be decided by 1, 2, 3 percentage points, I'm looking at the fact that there are like 14 or 15 candidates who have no chance of winning this race, but who still may get 1, 2, 3 percent each. So how does that have any impact on the final result?
I think not. I mean, the ones you're talking about are the ones that individually can't get more than a fraction of a percent, and so you're talking about a cumulative effort. I think there, with all these higher profile candidates, we've got like one upper tier, then we've got kind of a middle tier, and what they all, both tiers have in common is they're going to spend a tremendous amount of money. And so when we get down to the very end, if you know, people ask me, well, why is this person running for the Senate, or why is this person running for governor? Some person that's, you know, like a local homeroom teacher,
like
or something.
Like a Leonard Steinman or
and
something.
And it's just
like
so,
that.
It's just so, you know, when somebody does their eulogy, it's in the, you know, when they die and somebody talks about them, they talk about the fact that they ran for governor or U.S. Senator someday. That's all it is, really. It's a vanity thing. But I think in this race, they'll have minimal impact, because so much money is going to be spent by at least, you know, five or six candidates. And I think that cumulatively it could be, you know, 0.5%, but nothing more than that.
So let's get to the major candidates. Mark McCloskey, he's an attorney. He gained national fame or infamy, depending on how you want to describe it, when he and his wife were photographed and videotaped holding guns outside their homes as protesters walked to then-Mayor Lyda Crewson's house. Now, when McCloskey got into this race last year, and I was talking with people at like Lincoln Days in 2021, a lot of them felt that McCloskey was like a major candidate because of his fame in conservative circles. But it seems that looking at polling and fundraising numbers, he just hasn't really reached that top tier. Why do you think he is where he is right now?
Well, only because he's put in the effort. You know, when you mentioned 2021 Lincoln Days, well, there's Lincoln Days in 2021 and Lincoln Days in 2022, and it's always easy to get people to come speak in an election year. It's impossible to get them to come speak 2 years before an election year. And Mark has committed himself to that, and he's gone out on the stump, and he's spoke wherever he's asked to speak, and he's given a really good talk. He presents himself as a complete outsider, but an outsider that has a close personal relationship with Trump. He raised money for Trump in both of his election cycles. And he's got nice stories to tell, and he's told them well. And I think that he's viably going to, you know, he's going to get 2 or 3 percentage points if he continues on this pace.
And I think he's worth like $20 or $30 million. Couldn't he self-fund and be more impactful than 2 or 3%?
Well, I think if he hasn't figured it out already, he should know soon enough that he really doesn't have a chance of winning this race, and like no chance of winning. But I think, you know, maybe at his eulogy it'll be more than just one sentence when he talks about having run, because I think he will run and he will get some votes, and he plays a role in this race. He's from the eastern side of the state, and that's a theme throughout this whole campaign that's an issue, and he's an outsider, and he has a friendship with Trump, and I think all those things are positives, and I think he'll end up with 2 or 3 points.
So let's talk about Senate President Pro Tem Dave Schatz. And again, somebody who is not very well known. I mean, one of the things that I think our listeners need to understand here is just because you're president pro tem of the Missouri Senate does not mean you're a household name. Just ask Steve Gaw in 2000.
Ask all the ex
Mike
pro
Gibbons,
yeah,
all right. With the exception of Peter Kinder, who right. won lieutenant governor. Right. He's already put in $2 million of his own money. And granted, we're talking about a Senate race where $2 million is a rounding error, but that's still a significant amount of money to run TV and radio ads. Like, where does he factor into this contest?
Well, again, I think with that kind of money spent, and he has a base of support. He's out of Franklin County. He owns a blue collar business, and there's a certain type of Republican that really would look and admire him for his professional success. I think a lot of the conservative Democrats over the last 10 or 20 years that have gone over to the Republican Party would really relate to Dave. I've come to be of the opinion that really what he's doing in the U.S. Senate race is just a prelude to running statewide in 2024. You know, the $2 million he'll spend, it'll get his name out there. He'll be on the debate stages if there's debate stages. And he'll introduce himself, and it's okay to introduce yourself in this race and to not win, especially, and to think about it, he really only is campaigning for 6 or 7 months, so he's not even sacrificing all that much in terms of the campaign itself, which can be really difficult. And then I would be shocked not to see him put his name in the ring for something like lieutenant governor in 2024. And in that race, lieutenant governor's race, he may not even have to spend that much money, having spent what he did in this U.S. Senate race.
So let's talk about the candidate that I find to be the most fascinating out of the bunch, and that's Congressman Billy Long. I think he kind of straddles between the second and tier and the main tier. And I'll just be brutally honest here. if Trump doesn't endorse him, I think he's a second-tier candidate. I think if he does endorse him, I think he's in the same tier as Schmidt, Hartzler, and Greitens. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he's guaranteed to win, as I'll ask in a second. That's my observation. What's kind of your feeling of where Congressman Long falls in this race?
I felt all along that if Trump were to endorse Billy, that Billy would probably win the race. Billy is a very authentic human being. His first run for office was Congress 10 years ago. He's a self-made person. He's a likable guy. And
His tweets have been amazing as of late. They're a little psychedelic, but have you seen his tweets
he's attacking the other candidates through his tweets a little bit.
Yeah, I think that he clearly is drinking a lot of caffeinated beverages at 1 o'clock in the morning, but continue.
Well, Billy's completely anti-establishment. And the mistake I think that he made is that he didn't adopt this kind of populist nationalist language that Greitens has taken on. That message is very, very strong. And Billy doesn't really articulate that message so specifically. His is more of a general, hey, I'm anti-establishment because establishment's horrible, and, you know, his kind of anti-swamp, that kind of thing. But, you know, you can see by the President Trump's tweets that he's dying to endorse Billy, but Billy can't get into a lane where it looks like on his own he can get 8 or 10%, and it's getting late now. I think that the closer we get to the end, Trump's endorsement may help the top two people move ahead of each other, but I don't think it's enough to push Billy ahead 3 or 4 spots.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, because I do think that there is this feeling that in Missouri, where President Trump, whether you like him or not, probably had the biggest symbiosis with Republican voters. Maybe Reagan is the only other comparable when you look at the actual results. But, like, I think that there is this myth that, like, his endorsement automatically means that somebody wins a primary, because that's not necessarily true. Madison Cawthorn was not endorsed by Trump, and he beat Trump's candidate. He also has endorsed complete duds like Mo Brooks in Alabama. And frankly, David Perdue is looking like a big dud right now and is on pace to being shellacked by Kemp in Georgia.
Yeah, so you watch the Trump is very involved now in all different types of races. And actually, somebody talked, it was described, the group of people that are around him is kind of like the endorsement consultant class now.
Yeah.
There's a whole group of people, most of whom are working for one of the candidates here, trying to get Trump to endorse. And Trump tends to endorse. It's not ideological at all. Sometimes it's who can be the front runner. He likes the glamour person. He likes Herschel Walker. He likes attractive female candidates. And then he also endorses people that are against people he has a strong vendetta against. The one thing that's interesting is that Trump has made no secret of the fact that if he were to be elected president again, is he does not want Mitch McConnell involved in power.
Mm-hmm.
And so Greitens recognized that idea and came out early, I think last fall, and said that he would not vote for McConnell. And I'm shocked that none of the other candidates are smart enough here in Missouri to echo that.
We're going to talk more about Greitens in a minute.
Right.
But my understanding is, like, voting for majority leader is not like Speaker of the House. Like, it's done internally. So if, let's just say Greitens wins, and it's like 50-1 for McConnell, does that really matter in whether McConnell serves or not?
Yeah, I've heard that pushback. But the reality of the situation is you get into a Senate majority leader contest, and you may walk out of the door where it's unanimous, but along the way, it's been contentious. And there are other people, I'm sure, in that caucus today that are also sick and tired of Mitch McConnell, but they're not going to go. They care more about their committee assignments. They're not going to go against him unless there's a path to victory.
I want to talk about Eric Schmidt first, because you actually served in the Missouri Senate with him. The thing that we were talking about before the show is he has never actually run in a Republican primary with opponents before. Is that going to be a problem for him?
I know Eric. I consider Eric a personal friend. I've known him from when I first got into politics. I served all 4 of my years. I served alongside Eric. And Eric is a professional politician. He works very hard at his craft. He embraced fundraising very early on. He does not like to have an opponent for whatever office he's running for. He wants to have as weak an opponent as possible. And he knows that there's ways to do that kind of behind the scenes, deal making, that kind of thing. Eric ran for Senate the first time And his Democratic opponent was offered a really choice assignment on a paid commission, and that cleared the field for Eric. And then he didn't even have to run for re-election the second time, which is very unusual for a state senator in the St. Louis area. So he's very adept at clearing the field. He ran for the treasurer. He raised $5 million to run for the treasurer's office, where no one's ever spent more than $1 million ever. And he did it, did a deal to get put into the attorney general's race. And then when he ran statewide, there was really not a race. There was never a primary, and the race wasn't even real. So Eric he's been loath to have people take shots at him. Others around in the Senate he was relatively thin-skinned at times, but he knows what this is all about. He's prepared himself for a long time to run for this office. You see him fundraising. He'll be the top fundraiser by far in traditional sense, meaning going out not just PAC money.
I think his PAC has raised like $3 or $4 million.
Yeah, no, he is hardwired to do this. That aspect of the campaign. He's not a risk taker politically. He's very methodical. He supports things that are very popular, and then he stays on them. And so, I think is it an issue that he's never had an opponent? I think. Maybe, but I think he prepared himself to be attacked. He's prepared himself for what's coming.
I mean, I think that the attacks are going to be like he was too moderate in the Senate, and they're going to point to votes. And the whole 2011 Erotropoulos situation, I'm sure, is going to get exploited. I mean, it already kind of is right now. Are those overcomable obstacles?
We'll see. There's two problematic issues. One is every Republican in the caucus at the time voted to allow Smithfield Foods to sell themselves to the Chinese. This is something the Farm Bureau lobbied for. It's something that Smithfield Foods themselves lobbied for. And at the time this decision was made, all Republicans voted to override Jay Nixon. It was an idea, we're a free country. You can sell
your
property.
Were you in the Senate when that happened?
I was in the Senate.
Did you vote to override that?
All of us voted to override that vote. So that is simple and easy to understand, and that will be used like a hammer on him all across the state.
I got to ask this question, though. If a Polish company had bought Smithfield instead of a Chinese one, do you think this would be an issue that anyone would use as an attack?
Obviously not. What's different now than then, and this is 2011, 2012, 13, that period, is that the whole country was still trying to figure out how to do business with China. All of commerce... A chamber of commerce is all around the country, national chamber of commerce. The whole country was kind of hardwired into doing business with them. The Erotropoulos, the China hub legislation that he carried aggressively for 3 years, would have allowed for flights in and out of China. And I'm not certain on this, but I think it was in and out of Wuhan. So had that passed, can you imagine what would have been the case if we had flights coming in and out of Wuhan during the COVID? But that was then, this is now. And now that's a very detrimental and easy to understand. It's a great 30-second attack ad. And I think he's going to be hit over the head time and time again. Now, he knows that. The campaign knows that he's, the fact that he was a moderate Republican, well, he's moderate in the sense that he was a Chamber of Commerce
Eric
Republican.
Greitens was a liberal Democrat for a while. So, I mean.
Right, right.
I mean, that's overcomable, obviously.
Right. So that's a nuanced thing. And most primary voters, or most voters in general, they don't have an attention span to get into nuance. But what's easy to understand is you voted to sell our farms to China. You voted to bring flights in from Wuhan. And therefore, I'm against you.
We'll be right back after this quick break with former state senator John Lamping.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
And we're back on Politically Speaking with John Lamping. He used to be in the Missouri Senate, but now is like a wine grape grower and a financial advisor.
So I've always been a financial advisor, and I returned back to that after I came out of the Senate. But then I moved my family and we moved out to Augusta in 2017, mm-hmm. and we grow grapes. So we have a small vineyard, and we sell to a local winery, and the one that's not owned by Hoffman. And so that's what we do. And from there, on top of the hill, I get to watch Missouri politics from afar, which is a great place to be.
Very much so. So let's talk about the two other candidates in the race. So Congresswoman Vicky Hartzler seems to have a lot of momentum right now. Her fundraising, even before Holly endorsed her, was actually really, really good. Like, she was pulling in $700,000 quarters, and people were like, wow, I didn't know Vicky Hartzler could raise that much money. And I think it's pretty obvious now that a lot of the state's Republican heavyweights are behind her. Josh Hawley, as I mentioned, Kit Bond, who is still pretty influential in Republican circles. The other thing that I think she has going for her is she has a lot of credibility as a social conservative. Like, where do you think that she stands in this race right now?
Well, she's the perfect candidate. She's a clean slate. She served 6 years in Missouri's House. She served 10 years in the Congress. She is not controversial in any way, shape, or form. She's very modest and humble in her approach to politics. It just so happens that, you know, her brand of social conservatism, you know, anti-abortion and really and a non-LGBTQ supporter, she's at the perfect time now to be that, right? So this is a year we're probably going to have Roe v. Wade. Republican primary voters are going to be in favor of Roe v. Wade being overturned. That's where she is on that position. And where, you know, this whole issue surrounding the introduction of transgenderism into you know, pre-K is it allows for her to be adamantly opposed to LGBTQ and be in the right lane at the right point in time. So I think she catches those two things perfectly. She is the establishment candidate, make no doubt. I mean, we've had Senator Bond has publicly endorsed her. For those that don't know, Senator Bond is his and people around him are very, very large lobbyists here at the state and the federal level. The Blunt family is certainly behind Vicky, which means Mitch McConnell is behind Vicky. They're smart enough not to say these things out loud because the primary voters aren't big fans of either of those two. She is somebody who she will be a very quiet, safe vote, and she will listen to what all the lobbyists around her have to say.
I know that the voting, the GOP primary voters are probably older, and I would say that they're not in favor of LGBTQ rights. But I've run into a lot of people who are my age. I'm 37. And their views of gay, lesbian, people who are transgender, even if they're Republican, it's just not really the same as like what Hartzler is espousing. Is it possible that could, in a really close race, that could actually be a detriment to her if like a younger Republican voter looks at what she's saying as like, I'm just not enthused by that message of being anti-LGBTQ.
No, it won't be. It won't be an issue in this race because, look, all the candidates are going to be adamantly against. They're all for the Florida bill that keeps this education out of K through third grade. That's going to be part of their campaign. That's part of what they've got to say to seem to be credible. So, there have been cycles where to be a more moderate, socially conservative Republican is what the electorate seems to be looking for. That in that cycle, but in this cycle, that is not the case at all. She fit her very conservative to the right views on these issues fit perfectly with where the electorate is this time around.
All right, let's talk about Eric Greitens a little bit more in depth. Now, just for our listeners, you were a supporter of Eric Greitens' gubernatorial campaign in 2016, but you are not supporting him this time, and you are not support. You're just an observer.
Yeah, my relationship with Eric Greitens. I was still in the Senate. I met him for the first time. He was kind of a clean slate. We spent a good 6 months kind of bringing him up to speed on all the issues. I officially was the chair of his party to committee to consider running for office. He obviously won the race. My rationale for getting behind him was I really believed that the policy things that he would do and would be very conservative. They were. And a lot of the people that I served with and around and people that helped me, they became part of his administration. And so that's my relationship with him. What's transpired since, I'm not publicly supporting Eric. I do believe, though, I'm very much in the kind of the populist nationalist lane. That message that he's carrying, I really wish the rest of the other candidates would listen to it. That message itself is worth 10 or 20 points, regardless of who's carrying it. Mm-hmm. But so that's why I have no problem with him staying in this race, because I think that message needs to be out there. But I'm afraid it's going to be drowned out by the traditional Missouri Republican Party campaign rhetoric.
Do you feel that the affidavits that his ex-wife has submitted under oath, I mean, are they so damaging to his campaign that he has no chance of winning? Or do you think that he could somehow overcome them with the pushback that he's doing?
I think it's a it's just a traditional campaign action against him. What I mean by that is that this thing got thrown out into this the ozone, and that's all he can talk about. He has to defend himself. It's and nobody hears anything else. People that support him and believe him say they listen to what he has to say. Go, oh my gosh, there's no way this is a coincidence. Okay, this was organized. It doesn't mean that it's not true. It just means that it was released on a Monday morning a month ago. It was released very specifically to achieve what it's achieved. And so what that means for Eric Ryans is Eric Ryans can't talk about anything else, and nobody else hears anything else. And that's where I think he's probably hit his ceiling early in this race. And 26-7 is not going to be enough to win.
But I've seen his responses to it, and it really centers around this is a conspiracy to get me out of the race because Mitch McConnell fears me. He's not leading with, no, I didn't push my wife down. No, I never physically or emotionally abused my kid. And I know that he's denied both of those things, but the fact that he's leading with this is a conspiracy, it does make you wonder whether they're true, especially since Sheena Greitens said those things under oath, and Eric Greitens has never gone under oath with this case or the case in 2018. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that it's an instance where both things may very well be true, and Eric's talking about the conspiracy part of it. And the conspiracy part of it is to the sense that, look, Mitch McConnell is fighting against this message all across the country, mm-hmm. not just in Missouri. And it is true that they cannot have Greitens be successful, and they will do all they can to eliminate him from this race. It's not him personally. It's him. It's the message he carries.
Do you think that people are energized to fight against Greitens because they fear that he will be a weak general election opponent, or because, A, they believe what Sheena said in that affidavit, and they also believe what KS said in 2018. B, he was a governor who made lots and lots of enemies by not making friends with a lot of people, and or C, that people are just tired of Eric Greitens and they just want him to go away and would rather not deal with him. Maybe that's why Josh Hawley doesn't want him in the Senate. Like, what do you think about that?
Well, let me say people. So I think ordinary people, voters, primary general election voters, the message he's carrying, they would rally behind that message. They look at the two parties as a kind of a uniparty. It's a cartel, and they feel like they're on the outside looking in. So the people, I think, support him, generally speaking. They support that message. Now, what you're referring to, though, I think, instead, is the political class.
Yes.
Okay, so the political class hates him for the same reason the political class hated Trump before 2016 and hate him even more once he got into office. Because what they know to be true, and this was proven true in Greitens' case when he was a governor, is he won't listen to the political class. He doesn't care what all the political consultants say. He doesn't care. I mean, look, the Blunt family are the largest lobbying family in the state of Missouri. Bonds are right behind them. Political operatives work for all the candidates. They want to be heard. Not only they want not just to be heard, they want to be able to successfully achieve the goals of their clients. And if Eric Greitens is a U.S. senator, he'll have no time for them, and they'll have no influence with him. So that's the biggest reason they're trying to get him out of the race. Now, they'll say he'll lose in the general election. Well, they're just trying to appeal to people's emotions. But the reason they don't like him is because he doesn't care what they think.
Based off today, which is April 19th, 2022, who do you think will win the Republican primary?
If the vote was next Tuesday, I think Vicky would win. She's got tremendous momentum right now, and she's got the most powerful people behind her and the establishment, both establishment in Missouri as well as a national establishment. I have tremendous faith, though, in Eric Schmidt's campaign. I think the people in Jeff Rowe's running his campaign, but there are more than just Jeff Rowe working his campaign. I think they have to have a plan. They have to have an arc. And what you'll see, if I'm right, is you'll see Eric Schmidt will be within shouting distance all the way up to the very end, and then he'll win by 4 or 5 points if they've done it correctly. So they have not launched their plan yet. That's not part of the deal. What you want to do is you want to peak on election day. It's way too early. I think Vicky is riding a very high wave right now. If we held the election next Tuesday, she'd be the candidate.
So in the last few minutes that we have, I want to go over a number of topics that I think we'll just deal with in quick bursts. Let's go to St. Charles. Mm-hmm. So there's a primary between Steve Ellman and State Senator Bob Onder. And this race is interesting from afar. As a St. Louis County resident who lived in a place with very restrictive COVID regulations. It is kind of odd that Ander is running against Elman and basically saying that Elman is a COVID scold when it's widely perceived that St. Charles County did not really enact very strict regulations against COVID. That seems to be the main thrust of Ander's campaign, beyond the fact that he's saying Elman's been there too long. Like, is that going to be a attractive message?
Well, it remains to be seen. The general perception in St. Charles County was that St. Charles County did not take control of principally what went on in schools, masking in schools. That was where the issue, that's where the differential really is, that the parents themselves were adamantly against the masking going on in schools. And what Steve did is Steve fell back on kind of what the state was recommending. So he didn't come out and assert himself as a county executive. Look, I like both these people a lot. Steve, I consider them both friends. I'm probably more ideologically aligned with Bob. I think Bob would be a great county executive. I do think Steve's been the county executive for 20 years, and it's time for a new blood. I think that would be that's a good enough message. I also think St. Charles County is at a crossroads. When you go back to early 80s, and St. Louis County was kind of a 50-50. Maybe it was Republican leaning. I mean, we had McNary as the county executive. Republicans in St. Louis County felt very comfortable in being Republicans in the majority. And if you look at St. Charles County now, it's Republican, but it's 55-60% Republican. And we're at a crossroads where I think that the county can make big changes. Steve's been there for 20 years. This will be an interesting race. I think right now my understanding is that like Bob controls the west side of the county and Steve the east side of the county, and it's who can get their votes out.
Hoping to get both of those candidates on before Election Day. Redistricting, I know you're a 7-to-1 person. We had Bill Eigel on the show last week, and I think he did actually a really effective job at articulating the 7-to-1 message, so I want to give him a lot of credit for that. I think that this is my prediction. I think that the end game is that it's a 6-2 map with a more Republican-leaning second district than what the House put out, but it will not look like what the Senate put out, which I said to Bill Eigel very bluntly is a ridiculous-looking district that stretches from my house in Richmond Heights to Northern Iron County.
Right.
Like, I think that that district will not be the final district. Do you have any sense of where this is going to shake out?
Hopefully it ends soon. Look, I'm for a 7-1 map, but I was never, ever, ever, ever going to happen. Mike Parson is a governor who does not want to take the lead on anything. I'm not a big Mike Parson fan. Serve all 4 years with Mike, too. It's ridiculous that he did not call a special session last year to have this map drawn. And the way we were going to get to a 7-1 map in this state would be if Parson himself wanted that map. He never wanted that map, and so it was never going to happen. What I would have hoped that the advocates for 7-1 in principally the Senate, I would hope that they were advocating for 7-1 to get a stronger 6-2. And it remains to be seen. We haven't got the map drawn. We don't know that Ann Wagner's district is stronger. It needs to be much stronger. It's ridiculous the way it currently is drawn. And who knows? Jason, it sounds like maybe we're going to run the old districts in 6 months, 7 months, and look for a federal court to draw the new ones in the off year.
Now, my final question for you is actually looking to 2024. And there is this shadow primary going on between Lieutenant Governor Mike Kehoe and Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft. I'm almost positive that both of them are going to run for governor. I think Kehoe has already announced. Ashcroft is probably going to announce after the 2022 election cycle. And I think that both of them bring some advantages to this race. Like, Kehoe is well-known in mid-Missouri. He's going to get a lot of institutional support. But Jay Ashcroft has probably 100% name recognition. I didn't actually know this until I checked. I believe that he got more votes than Robin Carnahan did in 2008. So, like, he's already proven that he can win by wide margins. How do you think that this race is going to shake out in a couple of years?
It remains to be seen what kind of campaign Jay is going to run. I know Jay a little bit, and I find him to be a very honorable person, an upstanding person who really does view political service purely as public service. He's not in it. I mean, he was the son of a very famous person. He knows what fame and notoriety brings to you. He's not seeking that out. He's seeking service. Mike Keogh has been campaigning to run for governor since the day I met Mike Keogh in 2010. That's when he and I both were swept into office. Mike is a conservative Democrat who is now a moderate Republican. Mike, there's a textbook path to any statewide office. It's the one that Vicky's following now, but Mike knows what this path is, and that is to understand and get to know and get the support of all the institutional groups to carry water in the legislature, which he has done on numerous occasions. To run statewide. He ran as lieutenant governor, so he's got high name ID. Mike works the state every single week. He's out two or three or four places working the state. It's no secret.
And I'm sure he's going to disagree that he's a conservative Democrat. He's going to probably claim that he's a very conservative Republican.
Well, if you look at who supported Chris Koster in the race for governor in 2016, probably half to two-thirds of the groups that endorsed Chris Koster will be endorsing Mike Keogh this time around if they haven't done so already. And I think it's pretty safe to say.
So like the NRA and the Farm Bureau, like those are pretty conservative groups.
Cattlemen's Association. I mean, one after the other. Like, look, one of the reasons I was excited to meet Eric Greitens when I did and support Eric Greitens when I did is because Chris Koster was the de facto governor, and he had a lot of moderate Republicans that were privately supporting him. So Mike Keogh knows all those things. Mike Keogh lives in Jefferson City. He completely understands Missouri politics. He'll be very, very formidable opponent. If you ask me to guess today who's going to win, I'd say he's going to win. But it remains to be seen if Jay Ashcroft has the ability to run a campaign that he'll need to run, which is to be the true conservative and really kind of an outsider to somebody who's very much an insider.
I think it's going to be – the reason I'm actually excited for this race is it really has the potential to be a battle of ideas. And it may be less personal than the Senate race. And that is a genuine – I'm more of a policy person than a politics person – generally, that's kind of exciting.
It is.
I hope that I'm right on that and it doesn't turn into a mud fest, but I think it could really be like a battle of ideas.
I think that's right. I think if it's just the two of them and they square off, I think that it'll lend its, I think Jay will be, and I think that he'll be willing to lose on his ideas alone. But we'll see. I mean, that When you go down the path of running and campaigning for offices for years after years after years, you're loath to lose, and at the 11th hour, you're easily talked into doing something you may otherwise not do in a commerce situation.
We shall see. Thank you so much for coming in. For all of our stories, stlpr.org. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is part of the University of Missouri St. Louis. You can follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. You can follow John Lamping at...
I'm on Twitter at John Lamping.
We'll be back next time. So long.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.